Welcome to Global Journalist on KBIA. This is the program that says mid-Missourians, indeed many Americans, are interested in international news. I'm Stuart Lurie of the Missouri School of Journalism. This is an important week for international news. Russia's problems with Chechnya are deepening. Saudi Arabia's government said it will not allow American forces based there to be used to fight Iraq. The royal family in Great Britain is involved in a new controversy over the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. The royal family in Great Britain is involved in a new controversy over the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. In Israel, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's coalition government has dissolved and he has taken on new partners. The CIA killed an al-Qaeda leader in Yemen with a missile from an unmanned airplane. But the big story here in the United States right now is the midterm election last Tuesday, featuring a resounding victory by President George W. Bush's Republican Party. It has widened its lead in the House of Representatives, something parties in power seldom do at midterm, and it has regained control of the Senate. How is this viewed around the world? Is it a good sign or not? To talk about today, we have as guests in London, Simon Tisdall, assistant editor of The Guardian. In Yemen, Faris Sarabani, editor and publisher of the Yemen Observer in Aden. In Tokyo, Michael Zelenziger, bureau chief there for the Knight Ridder newspapers. And in Lima, Peru, Hugo Guerra, subdirector of the newspaper El Comercio. Let's start in Europe. Simon Tisdall, does this election outcome give President Bush any greater mandate to go to war against Iraq?
Well, coming on top of the vote in Congress, which overwhelmingly supported his policy towards Iraq, and given that the Security Council appears about to endorse a resolution that the United States has put forward toughening the inspection regime on Iraq, the midterm elections looks like a triple whammy for that policy, that it looks unstoppable now and will go the way that Mr. Bush wants it to go. That's not to say that many people in Europe are any happier about it, and a lot of concern persists among allies and general public in Britain and elsewhere that this will make a bad situation worse.
Well, you say the general public in Britain, yet the British government is in full support with President Bush, isn't it?
The British government is out of step with public opinion, according to the latest opinion polls, and indeed polls going back through most of the year. There are majorities here against British involvement in an attack on Iraq. Most people would like to see it solved in a peaceful and diplomatic way, which has been a long-standing approach, and also the ending of sanctions. And there are divisions within the ruling Labour Party, and there are divisions within Tony Blair's cabinet. Perhaps it's not fully appreciated how out on a limb Mr. Blair will become on this if the US decides to go it alone without full UN authority and Britain supports it. That could well lead to his downfall.
Yeah, Hugo Guerra, how about in Peru and Latin America? What impact, if any, has this election had on relations between Latin American countries and the United States?
Well, for us, this election means that President Bush could have enhanced powers to deal with the implementation of the ALCA and some free trading agreements, such as the one that he signed with Chile. For Peru, that would be good news for President Toledo. As you remember, President Toledo is a very close friend to President Bush. But our main concern is about the policy on human rights and the environment. As you know, Republicans are very tough on those issues. And also, I'm so concerned with the policies towards the cartel.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that last thing.
I'm so concerned about the Republicans' policies on trafficking policies. I think maybe the White House will
I think we have lost Hugo Guerra. Let's go on to Tokyo. Michael Zelenziger, how are the elections being viewed there?
Well, I think for the Japanese, this is a big dilemma because the security issues have now... It used to be that we worried in Japan about the economic pressure from the United States, but now we're getting security pressure from the United States because Japan has traditionally been a fairly pacifist government with a, although a relatively large military one that has never been deployed. Since September 11th of last year, there's been a great deal of pressure from the Pentagon and the Bush administration for the Japanese to be more involved. The news in Japan today was very much spun to suggest that it's very clear that the Bush mandate from the American voters means a very tough approach to Iraq is imminent, and that will put Japan in a difficult position. The Defense Department and the State Department, especially the Rumsfeld Defense Department, want to see the Japanese, for instance, deploy Aegis radar ships to the Persian Gulf, which would once again tend to erode the Japanese pacifist approach towards foreign affairs. And the Japanese people are basically not in favor of a confrontation with Iraq. So a Japan where we used to fight a great deal about economic issues, is we're going to see more debate about the security relationship between these two fundamental allies.
And Faris Sarabani in Yemen, what is the feeling there about the augmented strength of the Bush administration?
As far as the election, not many people are paying much attention to it, except for those who are interested, the scholars and the politicians. As far for the general public, they feel that they've abandoned the idea of democracy from the United States. They feel that they don't look at the state as the protector of democracy and human rights anymore. A number of people, elder people, have expressed to me verbally that they feel that Bush has hijacked democracy and going full force at Iraq, regardless and irrelevant of the Senate and whoever matters there.
Yeah, Faris, last weekend, the CIA operated a drone airplane, an unmanned airplane, that shot a missile at a car and killed an Al-Qaeda high-ranking leader in your country. How has that been handled there?
Actually, we're getting mixed signals from the government. That has not been, they declined to make any statements. The only comment that they came up with that investigation into the car crash is still underway. However, we're getting mixed signals from, let's say, opposition parties in the country and from tribesmen and from human rights groups. They disapprove of the way it was handled. They say that it was an execution without judgment. As we understand, there were six people who were killed in that car blast. Definitely, one of them is a top Al-Qaeda leader and has been identified as Abu Ali al-Haridi. A large number of people, or a growing number of people, approve of the U.S.-Yemeni ongoing cooperation, and they say, look at the results, he's out. Also, there is a growing fear of and tension in the air of revenge of Al-Qaeda. As you understand, the American embassy just closed yesterday. Their embassy here and the country is in literally full alert. Security-wise, they're worried that there might be a revenge attack by Al-Qaeda supporters to the attack that happened a few days back.
Yeah. Mr. Sarabani, do you know whether or not that plane was based in your country?
There is no comment on that, not officially from the Americans nor from the Yemeni government.
The Saudi Arabian government, of course, has said that it will not allow the United States to use bases in Saudi Arabia in any attack on Iraq. What will be the situation in your country?
We do not have any American bases in Yemen at all, nor do we have American forces. The ongoing cooperation between Yemen and the U.S. is limited to training of personnel of special forces and that kind of minimal 30 to 35 person at one time. We do not have a military base at all in the country.
And there is no pressure from the United States to put bases in your country.
The pressure is on to cooperate, but there has not been any request from the Americans to have a base in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Simon Tisdall, do you have any idea where American and coalition forces might operate from in the Middle East if the Saudis don't permit it?
Well, yeah, I think there is a fairly clear picture emerging. Despite the elections in Turkey, which have produced a new government there, which has a sort of Islamist flavor, the Turkish Armed Forces commander has been in the United States this week. General Franks was in Ankara last week. Reluctantly will be part of this if it happens. There's a lot of American military activity in Jordan. Jordan is a very big aid recipient of the United States. It will do its part. Kuwait has said that the American military can use the bases there, that the Kuwaiti military will not themselves be involved. U.S. Central Command from Tampa has set up field headquarters in Qatar. They have the 6th Fleet in Bahrain. And Saudi Arabia has been busily clarifying its position since the remarks by its foreign minister that you refer to. The State Department now says that that's not the end of the story, and if push comes to shove, those Saudi bases probably will be available to American forces, and I would expect that to be the case.
We now have Hugo Guerra back on the line in Lima. Hugo, is the activity in the Middle East and against Iraq not much of an issue in Latin America?
First of all, I'm so sorry about the phone connection. About the Middle East, yeah. For Peruvians and for the whole Latin America, that's a very important issue. And what we are expecting with President Bush is that he will, for sure, attack Iraq on the next days, and that will be really a tragedy for the whole region on the Middle East.
A tragedy, of course, for the whole region in the Middle East. What will be the impact on Latin America, if any?
Well, it's not a direct impact, but in the global society, you have to expand about all our brothers in the Middle East, of course. And I'm mainly concerned with Israel, because after the war in Iraq, the issue of the Israeli problem will be increased for sure.
Okay, we have to take a break right now. This is Global Journalist on KBIA. I'm Stuart Lurie. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Global Journalist. You may listen to this program again, ask questions, or make comments by going to www.globaljournalist.org or here in Mid-Missouri by calling us at 882-9641. Michael Zelenziger, if I may ask you about reaction in Japan and the Far East. There is, of course, another major story that the United States is involved in, and that is North Korea and the possible construction of nuclear weapons in North Korea. What are the likely developments there?
Well, it's interesting that American voters may not really appreciate it, but by giving the Bush White House a mandate, not only in the Senate but in the House of Representatives, allowing one party to dominate American politics and therefore dominate essentially American foreign policy, they're going to end up polarizing developments in Asia as well. Until the summer, both Japan and South Korea were very much hoping to open up the North Korean government to a quote-unquote sunshine policy. It's now very clear that when Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi went to Pyongyang in September to begin to pave the way to opening diplomatic relations with what has been a very isolated government. He knew about the American concerns that the North Koreans were redeveloping nuclear weapons. He still wanted to move forward. The Bush administration has come down very hard, both on Kim Dae-jung in South Korea and on the Koizumi government, to try to not have any more negotiations, to be tough against the North Koreans, and in a sense to put North Korea back in the refrigerator, back into the cold freezer, until the Iraq situation is dealt with. The Japanese, the South Koreans, and the Americans will meet again this weekend to figure out some kind of coordinated policy. But I should point out that at least from the perspective of Tokyo, the American administration itself has been divided between those who say we're willing to talk to Pyongyang anywhere and anytime, and those people who say, no, we have to stand tough and stare them down, and if we have to confront North Korea. So the American government has not spoken with one firm resolve at this point, and so it's been a little bit of a confusing time for the Japanese and for the South Koreans. And there are a lot of people, and of course in America and the American Congress, who are asking, why are we being so tough against the Iraqis and not as tough at the moment against the North Koreans? Yeah. Now, there are reasons for that, but that question is being asked.
Michael, I have to say that I get the impression from here in Missouri that the Bush administration no longer really considers North Korea to be a member of the axis of evil that the president talked about over a year ago. And that this latest development with the North Korean admission of what it was doing with its nuclear reactors, it has been an embarrassment to the administration.
Absolutely. I think it reflects the fact that the Bush administration was very, very focused only on Iraq, and the North Koreans, in fact, didn't like it. It's now fairly clear that the North Koreans made the admissions they made to basically tell to the White House, you can't put us in that cold storage, you can't put us in the freezer. Remember that the Koreans have made a number of significant moves over the past year to indicate we want to change our system, we want to move away from a dirigist, secluded, isolated empire and have more international relations. And it's the Bush people who keep saying, we don't want to deal with you now, we want to deal with Saddam Hussein. There's more than one group of scholars in Asia who believe the North Koreans will precipitate crisis until they can get on the front burner of the U.S. government, that they won't wait around to be dealt with. And the other side of the coin is the reason it's easy to attack Iraq as opposed to North Korea is that North Korea has had 50 years to build its troops into the sides of mountains, and attacking Iraq, a desert country with not a whole lot of army left, is a whole lot easier proposition. It's very difficult to attack North Korea and not see Seoul destroyed in the meantime. And so that creates tremendous military and logistical challenges for the Bush administration that wants to get a big win in Iraq first.
You said that you don't think there's much of an army left in Iraq. Simon Farris, how do you feel about that? Simon, you go first. What is the military situation in Iraq? Is it so that there is not much of an army left there?
Well, nobody really knows for sure, which is why we need the inspectors to go back. But most estimates by military analysts here, and I've seen in America too, suggest that the Iraqi army is a mere shadow of its former self, a mere shadow of the force that was confronted during Operation Desert Storm, that it's been denied spare parts and new machinery, new equipment, state-of-the-art missiles and so on. Most of the stuff's rusty and pretty useless. And also the loyalty of the mostly conscripted army is in doubt. There are only a few elite regiments that really might cause a problem to any invading force. So much the same goes for its supposed weapons of mass destruction as well. I think one of the problems of the forthcoming inspection regime will be that not much will be found, and then the Bush administration will have to say, well, that's because they've hidden it.
And do you think that might actually be the case, or do you think that there's not much to be found?
Well, I'm sure if Saddam Hussein's got anything half decent, he will have hidden it.
Mm-hmm.
And it won't appear on the inventory that they're supposed to produce in 30 days. And I'm quite sure sooner rather than later, the Bush administration will be crying foul about that. They'll be saying that the Iraqis are not playing fair, that they haven't owned up to what they've got, that they're not cooperating with the inspectors, that they're still playing silly buggers in the no-fly zone. And they'll go back to the Security Council and demand that everyone agree with them that the Iraqis are in material breach, and at that point you have a war. I think the Security Council story is not over by a long way, because at that point it will be open to permanent members and others to say, well, we don't agree with your judgment that they're in material breach, and you are not justified in launching an attack. So the whole wrangling that's been going on for the past 8 weeks isn't necessarily over once this resolution has been passed.
Farah Sarabani, is it generally felt in the Middle East that the Iraqi army is no longer very powerful?
I think if military action is taken, it would be very bloody. The issue here is not how strong the Iraqi army. The issue is that we have millions of people who have been grown to love a leader or taught to defend him and fight for him and fight with him. And as a result, there will be millions of volunteers, a million of people who will not have any training standing in line holding a gun. And as a result, you can see a lot of bloodshed. It's not from both sides. It will be only from the Iraqi people on the Iraqi side.
And do you think the guns are there to do all of this?
The what?
The weapons. Are the does the Iraqi military establishment really have the weapons to arm all of the volunteers and civilians?
Yeah, there is no match. Absolutely no match. You'll have people who are going emotionally versus to the latest technology versus to. It's like fighting a junior, fighting somebody who's not there. They just see weapons and arms and bombs landing everywhere. And unfortunately, if the war goes ahead, we will see a lot of blood and a lot of hatred and a lot of division among us. And I hope and I pray that it never comes to that situation and to that point.
Stuart, can I just come back on that? It's Simon in London again.
Please do, Simon.
It's just to say that, you know, I don't think conventional weaponry is the point here. The point is, Saddam does have probably stocks of biological and chemical weapons that were not accounted for when the inspectors left in 1998. And if he is faced by an invasion which will inevitably end in his own removal or death, the chances are he will use those weapons if he has them and if they're still viable. And that is what George Tenet of the CIA told Congress a few weeks ago. And that is the real risk, not conventional forces.
So the real risk is the weaponry that we are so concerned about, and rather than go in and try to destroy it, it's better to do nothing. Is that the general idea?
Well, George Tenet's assessment was that the circumstances in which Iraq was most likely to use those sorts of weapons of mass destruction, if it has them, are exactly the circumstances which are now envisaged by the Bush administration in making a military attack on Iraq. And one of the first recipients, and asked the Israelis, not me, the Israelis will tell you that they are frightened stiff, that if it's the last thing he does, Saddam Hussein will fire off chemical or biological weapons at Israeli cities, and they already have, you know, very serious contingency plans of mass casualties in place in cities like Haifa.
Yeah. Simon, part of the judgment here in the United States is that although he may have the chemical and biological materials that you're talking about, he really doesn't have the weapons to deliver them, the missiles.
I think that's entirely possible. I mean, I think in a way the Bush administration is a victim of its own propaganda here. I mean, for years, not just them, but Clinton administration before them, have been saying that the Pentagon, the CIA, the DIA have been saying Iraq maybe have this, maybe has that. It's got these scuds. We don't know where they are. So this picture is about that they've got these missiles that can deliver these weapons long distance. I mean, George Bush in Cincinnati recently even claimed the Iraqis had unmanned aerial vehicles of the type that was used in Yemen this week, which were capable of attacking U.S. cities. Now, this is fantasy stuff. It's just no basis in fact. But the perception has
to point out that this administration is, sorry to interrupt, but this administration has also been willing to accept sort of doctored intelligence to justify itself to Congress. We've had reports in the papers in the last 3 or 4 weeks that, you know, material has been juiced up, so to speak, to deliver to Bush to make the case, even though, as Simon points out, the real facts on the ground don't necessarily justify it.
That kind of thing is not really unprecedented, though, is it? It's what we faced during Vietnam, and maybe even in the pre-World War II years.
I think you're right, Stuart, if I might take that on. I mean, it's entirely true. But the basic question here is, what is the threat that we're supposed to be countering? No one has really accepted, in Europe anyway, the argument that there is a real, present, urgent threat posed by Iraq, either to its regional neighbors or indeed to the West.
And to take the line one step further, what you even hear here in Asia is, okay, even if you've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, then what happens? A lot of people have been very amused that people in Washington have suggested that you would have a Japanese-like occupation of Iraq, and of course the circumstances are completely different.
Yep.
And it's hard to believe the Americans would be willing to, you know, create a new government and run the country for 5 years.
Yeah, it does seem pretty clear, though, doesn't it, that there is going to have to be some kind of occupation for some period of time. Faris Sarabani, are Americans going to be able to occupy a large country in your area of the world and get away with it?
I think it will be very difficult, especially in a country like Iraq. It is throughout history. It has been they're very tough and very rigid people, and it's nothing similar to Afghanistan, in which they were there. These are people who have been in the army. These are people who are trained. These are people who are educated. These are people who are brainwashed and mentally conditioned to hate Americans, or to hate occupation, or to hate. They have been brainwashed that the condition of their misery for the past few years is because of Americans. So I think it will be very, very difficult. And anyone who will be cooperating from their leaders who are outside are currently being portrayed as traitors.
Okay. We have just about a minute left, and if I may, I would like to give the last words to Hugo Guerra. Hugo, with all of the talk about what is going on elsewhere in the world, the United States is often accused of ignoring the problems in the Western Hemisphere. What can the Bush administration be doing, and what should it be doing to solve those problems? If you can do it in 30 seconds, please.
Hey, sure. Although 2 years ago, Mr. Bush told that Latin America is very important for his administration, but the strategy changes after 9/11 because Bush's administration moved priorities in order to be successful in the security of the United States. Now, when the Republicans have the majority in both Senate and the House of Representatives, they can stop the benefits to immigrants, especially Latin immigrants without the documents or legal. The Republicans want to have a green light to attack Iraq and problem solve. Latin America are in a second level for this.
Okay, so, Hugo, I'm sorry, but I do have to cut you off. We're out of time. Our guests today have been in Lima, Peru, Hugo Guerra; in Tokyo, Michael Zelenziger; in Yemen, Faris Sarabani; and in London, Simon Tisdall. Our director is Pat Akers, and our producers have been Sarah Andrea Fajardo and Mary Lou LeClaire. For all, I'm Stuart Lurie, global journalist. We'll be back next week.